Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught Offside. Suburbs of New York City in an apartment in Brooklyn, New York. Andrew Gundling, JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
Things are good, Andrew. It's been a good week of Champions League action.
Yeah, it really has. This Champions League has been very, very, very entertaining so far, I would say, the group stages.
The much maligned group stages. Because we hear so much about, and let's be honest, the knockout phases of the last maybe decade have been unbelievably entertaining. I'm not saying that they haven't, but the group stages are good and are interesting. And particularly when good teams are going through bad patches, they are very, very engrossing.
Yeah, I would agree. And we're seeing that. It feels wide open to a certain extent. And we're going to talk all about it. We've got a lot to discuss on the Champions League group stages. Also, a little bit later on in the podcast, we'll talk about the upcoming El Clasico, Barcelona and Real Madrid hitting each other at very interesting times. And Tarek Panja of the New York Times is going to join us too. The last time we spoke with him was during the Super League crisis. And our conversation with him was fantastic. I'd say the amount of response that we got to that interview was really significant. And so we thought now with a lot of interesting things happening in kind of the news sector of the sport, Newcastle takeover, the biennial World Cup idea being proposed by FIFA, we thought this was a good time to have Tarek back on the program. So we're hoping to speak with him in just a little bit. But of course, JJ, like we said, we begin in Europe with the Champions League. Those nights, those beautiful nights all across Europe. Where do you want to start, my friend? There were so many games that were really interesting in a variety of different ways. I'll defer to you here.
Let's start at the Wanda on Tuesday night. I think that's the way to go.
Liverpool and Atletico Madrid. 3-2, your final. It goes to Liverpool. That's a great away victory for them. It maybe didn't go according to plan. They were up 2-0. And you probably were thinking that not necessarily it was going to be a waltz, but at that point you didn't think it was going to get quite as tricky as it did. But they do escape with an important road 3 points against a very difficult opponent, the defending champions of Spain.
Yeah, I think the best way to describe it was an absolutely amazing result. That's 3 wins from 3, 9 points. But if not not a great performance, in fact, a pretty iffy performance, and had certain things not happened in the game, that went Liverpool's way, mostly the red card for Antoine Griezmann, Liverpool were kind of in trouble. Atleti caused Liverpool as much trouble, if not more, than any other opponent this season. I suppose if we were ranking the trouble opponents, it would be Atleti, closely followed by Brentford. I mean, Liverpool have made a pretty good start to the season. And this was definitely one of those nights where they were made to look uncomfortable. But I thought about it, and if you think about the way Atleti play, they're kind of set up to hurt Liverpool. You know, they sit off, and then they, at certain segments, once you enter their zone, they surround and tackle you tenaciously. The ball is turned over, and then you've got that Liverpool high line, which can be susceptible. And the next thing, they're in behind. And only for Alisson in the early stages of that game, in the first half, Liverpool could have conceivably been 2-0 up and then surrendered the lead 3-2, 4-2. That's how good the quality of chance that Atleti created.
It's no wonder that Jurgen Klopp hates the way they play.
Yeah.
Do things to make this easier for us.
But the words of Graham Hunter are rattling around in my head. He said about a month ago that he thought Atleti were a real, real bet to win the Champions League because they've got that tenacity, that defensive solidity. Like I said, you get into a certain zone and they're going to surround you and look to break on you. But more than that, they've got really, really good attacking players. If you saw the performance of Griezmann before the red card, if you saw Carrasco all through the night, and João Felix, they were excellent, Andrew. They were really good, and they gave Liverpool a tire of time. Now, I would say Liverpool themselves set up to, not obviously not on purpose, but not starting Fabinho, not having on the one side, having Salah, Keita, in front of Trent Alexander-Arnold, who's going to bomb forward, and leaving that big gap and hole in behind was really problematic. And yeah, on another night, Atleti win this one, Andrew, comfortably. But it wasn't that night, and there was a red card, which, look, very, very hard to quibble with. A challenge that reminded me of Nani against Arbeloa in a Champions League game. I think it was 2013. Was it the quarterfinal or semifinal? Real Madrid versus Manchester United. Remember that one? Where he's just trying to control the ball, clearly. But he's not aware of who's around him. And he catches Arbeloa in the upper abdomen. And it's a red card. And in this case, this was worse because he nearly beheaded Roberto Firmino. And it was a red, but there was it was a total accident.
Well, yeah, that's the unfortunate part about it is I think Griezmann, when he realized what he had done, I think even he was surprised. I don't think he was expecting a head to be there. You know, he's clearly, you can follow his eyes. He's following the path of the ball.
But I mean, there's nothing in the serious foul play law that says following the ball, your eyes, intent. There's none of that. You've endangered the safety of an opponent on the field, and you got to go. And he kind of, there was the usual protest you'd expect from an Atleti team, from a Simeone managed team, but there weren't really those protests from him. He was perturbed.
He looked surprised at first, but then maybe that's performative.
Yeah,
and he knew what he did, and I think he had to have known what was coming. You just can't do that. Like, I don't know.
Which was a shame for the, not for the game, because it was a superb game. Really, really high level game. But it was a shame for him because he was playing in a style of Griezmann pre his move to Barcelona. This was, and there's been criticism on his return to Atleti that he hasn't hit the heights yet, but you can't say he didn't do that on Tuesday night.
No, two goals. He scored both their goals. This was a weird game in that a couple of the attacking heroes for this game sort of end the night as villains in some way. Like, we're talking about Griezmann, who was brilliant in attack, scored the two goals, and he was having an incredible game, and then was sent off with a hideous challenge. Accidental or not, it is what it is. And then conversely for Liverpool, Naby Keita scored what was probably the greatest goal of his professional career, a volley in a Champions League match. And then he's yanked off at halftime. Klopp is clearly furious with the job that he's done. Mentioned before how, you know, he's partially ultimately responsible for that hole you were seeing in the midfield. He was not doing the things that Klopp wanted in defense. And after 45 minutes, after scoring this great goal, he's gone.
Yeah.
And Klopp just did a weird night.
Yeah. Klopp did this contradictory thing as well to defend. I mean, managers always defend their players, even when it's obvious what's going on. So he goes, no, Naby played a great game. He did some great things for us. We just needed more cover down the right-hand side. It was nothing to do with Naby. Well, it was something to do with Naby. You yanked him at halftime. It's okay to say that. It wasn't working out defensively. He was put in the spin cycle for the second Griezmann goal by João Felix. I mean, João Felix looks like a skinny middle schooler, and he held off Keita with ease and then spun past him. A brilliant run, which if you're a Liverpool fan looking for concerns, how easily Griezmann span into that space past Van Dijk and how far away Van Dijk was a concern. How far away Van Dijk was on a couple of occasions from Griezmann would be a little bit of a concern. Now, it's going to take Van Dijk a lot longer to come back from an ACL. These things take a lot of time to be back to his full speed and full tilt. So that is part of it.
The decisive penalty for Liverpool.
Yes.
The defending from, was it Hermoso?
Hermoso.
What's he doing?
Awful. Like, frankly, daft and unnecessary.
Extremely. So let's say that ball. So he, in real time, when I saw it, I thought legs tangled, harmless, like innocent mistake. Then you watch it and he lines him up. Like, does he forget where he is? Does he forget the rules? And let's say that ball comes down and Jota, somehow a ball that's dropping out of midair at that speed, let's say he plays it perfectly. He's still got a lot of work to do from where he is in the box.
Yeah,
it just felt like a moment, like if you're down 6-1 and you're just angry. Like a defender has just had a bad day and he's frustrated and he sees a ball up in the air and a guy staring at it and he's like, you know what? This is a chance for me to just absolutely level him. And you lose your mind for a second, you do it. But in a 2-2 game in a Champions League group stage match, like,
and a hanging ball,
very
it's,
weird.
It's it and he just shoves into him. Like he takes him out of it. It was crazy. Absolutely crazy. Now, you think of Atleti, you think of disciplined defending. That was not that. But equally, Andrew, we had an incident at the other end that could have swung it to for Atleti to rescue the game.
In the end, I think that it was the right call. I was much more torn on it, but I just can't help. Even though Jota does remind me who the player was for Atletico Madrid. I can't remember.
Jimenez.
That's right. So Jota does have an arm on him, but I'm sorry.
Can't give penalties.
I think Jimenez realizes at a certain point, I'm not going to get to this ball. I feel something on my back.
Yeah.
I'm going down.
Of course.
And I think that I'm kind of happy that the referee chose to not reward that. I feel like maybe it's a penalty that we have seen before.
Sure.
But it just, if it had been given, we'd be sitting here today saying that it was really weak.
Yeah, and it's the kind of penalty the Premier League are getting rid of, are trying to eradicate, and I can see why. Now, in real time, I thought it was a penalty. I was also annoyed at Jota for being wrong side. Mm-hmm. You know, that is an attacker defending a set piece late on. I don't care if that's the case. You've got to get goal side. And if you get goal side, that actually doesn't happen. Because if you watch, Jimenez does exactly what you said. He's not going to get there. And he dives across in front of Jota. He throws himself in front of him. But Jota leaves that option open to the referee. Now, thankfully, I thought there was a decent use of VAR. The referee is convinced it's a penalty. The VAR says, hey, take a look at this. And he goes and he does that. And he says, nah, I can't give that. There's not enough there. And in the end, the right decision is given. Now, that does not negate, like, and for our Atleti fans that are listening, that does not negate the fact that I think Atleti overall could have won this game. It doesn't change anything, but I just think that specific incident wasn't a penalty and the referee got it right.
Yeah. It is unfortunate, I think, with this game because it was lining up to be such a brilliant game. And in the end, it still was a very entertaining game, but I kind of would have liked to have seen it 90 minutes, 11 versus 11. It's a couple times this season where Liverpool, you know, they had the same deal with Chelsea. With the Reece James red card early on in that one.
Yeah.
A couple games this season where I really think so highly of this Liverpool team and they're playing so well. I want to see a normal game against them versus them against some of the other elite teams in Europe. You know, they have had those games too, but Chelsea, sure. Atletico, I would have liked to have seen a full 90 of 11 on 11.
I actually was quite happy that we didn't see that because I do think Liverpool on another night get beaten in this game. But like, look, That's not the way football works.
Right,
it's net. You're never across a 40, 50 something game season in all competitions going to be perfect. And Atleti have a lot of excellent players.
Yeah.
They've paid for a lot of excellent players. They pay for a very excellent manager. You know,
no, I mean, when you can bring Suarez off the bench,
that's
frightening. Certainly.
Yeah.
One other note from this one.
Yes.
So you're watching the game. It ends. And all of a sudden, you see a man in black sprinting down the tunnel.
Wasn't it brilliant, Andrew, to see Tom Waits looking so well on the sideline? I thought it was fantastic. Tom Waits,
really spry
soccer fan, obviously has great access. And Tom Waits in the middle of the game trying to get the Wanda, trying to get the crowd up. Brilliant, brilliant to see Tom Waits looking very fresh.
Yeah, he really did. It was actually Simeone, JJ.
Get out.
Can you believe it?
Stop it.
So the game ends and he sprints down the tunnel. Klopp is kind of left, I don't know, confused. Where is the man whose hand I'm supposed to shake right now? And so it seems like it's about to spiral into some kind of controversy. Now, this is a thing that Simeone does, and he has spoken about it. He said, I don't always greet the other coach after the game because I don't like it. It's not healthy for either the winner or the loser. I think of it that way. But now when I see him, I'll greet him without a problem.
Yeah. So I don't think there's any controversy here per se. But by the way, they don't, like, the two clubs have a lovely little rivalry brimming. It's good. It's good thing. There's a lot of hatred there. They stuffed us in that game, which is now subject to huge controversy the last game before COVID and how it was a super spreader event, but we'll park that. And so they don't like each other. But I'm curious to get your, like, if you do that in a youth match, if a kid won't shake the hand of another player, at like, it's a big deal. You know, I've always struggled with this convention. Like, you could be knocking the absolute pee out of a guy up for 90 minutes. There might be no respect. Things might have got said. And then the convention is you must shake hands with him to show respect after the game.
So I think with players, I mean, yeah, it's nice to think that everyone can shake each other's hand afterwards, but I understand the emotion of being a player in a game where, you know, something physical can happen. And so maybe there's a certain player whose hand you don't want to shake. The managers, just shake each other's hands.
Okay.
Just shake each other's hands. Every other manager on earth can do it. So can you. You may not like it. Just do it.
Yeah, and there's ways of doing it. I always think of the time in Mourinho's second period at Chelsea, when he came back, and Paul Lambert is manager of Aston Villa, and Roy Keane is his assistant, and they're sat there at Stamford Bridge, and they, like, Chelsea are winning like 3-1, and Mourinho goes for the shake hands on like the 90th minute with like 4 minutes of stoppage time left, and they just look like that to me. That's how you use it. That's how you weaponize the handshaking. But yeah, I think you might be right for the managers. But I do think, you know, if you don't respect the guy, if you don't like a guy, you know, the mutual professional respect should have been shown on the field already. Shaking hands afterwards doesn't make it so. I'm not a big shake hands guy.
But this was heightened though because of what you said about the rivalry. Klopp had said about Atletico Madrid and their style of play. He said, do I like it? Not too much, but I like a different style of football. I don't have to like it. It just has to be successful. But in very difficult times for football clubs, they have done an impressive job with signings, have a proper team, yada, yada, yada. There's a bit, like you said, there's a bit of an interesting European rivalry developing between these two teams.
Yeah, it's fun. It is fun. I will say this, you know, if I'm Klopp, I don't like the way they play because we don't tend to do very well against it and have struggled against it. And I thought Atleti were very impressive the other night. It wasn't just negative, stodgy. You know, they played with a lot of great skill and a lot of flair on the break.
Let's continue now, JJ. Let's go to Amsterdam, actually. Ajax and Borussia Dortmund. In one of the more, I would say, eye-opening results from these set of midweek matches, as Ajax went 4-0 over the German side. And by the way, like, I don't know if you saw any of this, if you saw highlights from this, they won 4-0. I mean, I don't think I'm exaggerating to say it felt like it could have been 6, 7, 8.
Oh, yeah. Not to bring it back to your own proclivities, but when you watch Ajax now, is this game like, you know, the what might have been game for you when you see Erik ten Hag on the sideline? Because that football, Andrew, that they play is, it's not that they won 4-0. It's not even that they could have scored 6 or 7. It's the way they play, the way they move the ball. It's like a 2019 redo, except with new players.
They're fun to watch. There's no question about it. And you do have to, I guess, respect that about them. And JJ, I wanted to read you something that I saw from the Who Scored Twitter account about Sebastian Haller.
Okay.
In this Champions League campaign thus far. So what's it been, 3 games?
3 games.
13 shots, 6 goals, 8 key passes, 2 assists, 14 aerial duels won, 2 Man of the Match awards, and a rating of 9.14. JJ, in Europe, so far, he's one of the best strikers there is. It's incredible.
It is incredible. And it goes to show you, I think there was 2 examples from the Champions League. He is the most striking example. But there's actually maybe 3 examples that the Premier League, we have this kind of, it's not an amnesia, but when players go away or it hasn't worked out for them in the Premier League, we think just not good enough. And it's not true. There are factors, there are personal factors, there are tactical factors, there are managerial factors, there's team factors. And Haller is about as big a bust as West Ham have ever had. He was their record signing at center forward. What did he score? 10 goals, something like that, in 40 games. Two assists, I think.
I'd have to look.
Yeah. 10 goals seems like a lot, actually. But I think it was, because didn't he get a hat trick at one point? So that would account for almost a third of those goals. But look at Haller. Look at Edin Dzeko as well. Like,
yeah, but Dzeko was a good player at Manchester City.
He was, but he's been literally forgotten about since he left the Premier League. And he's done great things at Roma and now, playing for Inter. But look at Dusan Tadic. Dusan Tadic was allowed to leave the Premier League for peanuts. So 12 million.
He's the weird one in this, because obviously when you talk about what you're discussing, he's someone you'll think of. But I don't think that he was viewed as any kind of failure at Southampton. Like, no. I think most people thought he was a good player.
No, he was. But how, when you think of some of the needs of the major teams, the top six teams, or even say an Everton, you know, who spent money all over the place on this very creative position, that he was allowed to just disappear into the ether for what in... I mean, it's the change you find down the back of a couch in Premier League terms. It's crazy to me that happened.
Well, Ajax is weird because they're such... I mean, look, they're such a historic club. They're a huge club. But because of the league where they play, like... Let me just ask you straight out. Maybe this is an ignorant question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So we view, because we're Premier League centric, Sebastian Haller going from West Ham to Ajax as a, what's he doing? Like Dusan Tadic from Southampton to Ajax. Why is he doing that? Why is he leaving the Premier League to go to that league? But are there still players who will view that as not a step down, but a step up because of what Ajax's reputation is?
100%. 100%. There are players who look at it, you know, I'm going there. All right. It's not brilliant league, but this is Ajax Amsterdam. Uh-huh. There's all that tradition with them, the stadium they play in, the stadium that, you know, that the person that it's named after, who we've discussed many times in this podcast, Johan Cruyff, everything that goes with them. And also a team that is now finding a way to be effective in European competition and be in the Champions League. It's kind of a good deal.
And I sometimes wonder, JJ, if Celtic look at Ajax and think, why can't that be us?
Oh, Andrew, like I'm in contact with a lot of, you know, Glasgow Celtic fans. I know a lot of them, and like they want this model. They want this kind of view production model that they had once upon a time, but a long time ago. And they want that. They absolutely want to be there, and they've also got the support, and they should have the revenue base to be able to do it. And they haven't. Have they bought well from abroad? Celtic, yes, but they've never done this. I mean, look at this forward line. You have Antony, Bergui, Tadic, Haller, and they've completely, well, more or less rebuilt their back four. They've rebuilt their. They were absolutely gutted after 2019, and now look where they are. 3 wins from 3, a couple of years later in the Champions League. It's brilliant, and you got to give Ten Hag a lot of credit for this.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else on this one, or shall we continue?
Just, I thought Marco Rose was the Borussia Dortmund manager, was very succinct describing his feelings after the game in one word, one German word, which we can say in German because this is an English-speaking podcast, but we couldn't say it in English. Scheiße. And he, one startling thing for me is that Rose does suggest that Dortmund gave up, but collapsed after the second goal. This is what he said. Our body language was like we were out of the game. After conceding the second goal, it was a matter of conviction. We have to work on that. We made too many mistakes, too many simple mistakes. When we were in the last third, we gave the balls away too easily and used too little movement to get into the crucial spaces. Too little movement is not something you usually accuse Borussia Dortmund of. But that was a bad night.
PSG, JJ, really fun one against Leipzig. They come back. They win it 3-2 thanks to a messy Panenka. You know my policy on Panenkas, JJ. If one of my players ever did it, they'd be yanked right off the field. This one would have been difficult to do that. but I do have a policy. And Leo, I'm sorry. You're out. It's time to go.
Yeah, I can imagine a stern-faced Andrew delivering that line to the greatest player we've probably ever seen. Leo, hi. So I have a pretty clear policy. It's in the lunchroom on the meeting board. It says no Panenkas. Yeah. You broke that. And let me tell you, friend, this is where it ends.
Have a seat. You're done. But yeah, Lionel Messi, 2 goals on the night for PSG. He's coming alive. And I know you, there's this continuing question about PSG and what they're doing right now. This, I don't know if we call it an experiment or what, but this, you know, Neymar, Messi, Mbappe triumvirate and how dominant they should be. And there's, it hasn't quite looked maybe the way we thought it would. Maybe we thought we'd be seeing more 5-1s or 4-0s or score lines like that. It hasn't been like that, both even in their own league. They've been eking by in some of these games. But I will say this, we should all be so lucky to struggle like PSG are struggling. They've won 11 of their 14 games in all competitions this season, 11-2-1. And they've won all seven matches played at home, outscoring their opponents in those games 19-6. So whatever, you know, their expectations are through the roof, and rightfully so. It's a collection of players, the likes of which we rarely ever see, if ever. But they are still winning and they are still playing well. And it makes you think, okay, if they're still getting wins at the rate that they're getting them now, where will they be come February, March, April, when presumably they've had time to gel? And maybe then we'll start to see the sort of score lines we thought we'd be seeing right away.
Yeah, I just think you can't get away from the fact that against better opposition than Leipzig, you're going to have a problem coming back from putting yourself in losing positions. You can't dig yourself out of every game, Andrew. It's going to be harder. I know they've already beaten Manchester City, but we saw how good City were in that game. And if you have City versus PSG in the semi-final, I'm taking the Jamie Carragher line on this on Paramount Plus. PSG won't be able to do this against the better sides. I don't see it. You can't keep going to the well like that. And eventually your luck runs out a little bit. And that's not to say that anything about Messi's skill or ability or the Panenka or the comeback is luck. But when you put yourself in a hole against good teams, it's harder to dig out. There was one funny moment on one of the Leipzig goals. I think it was the second goal, or maybe it was the first goal. So Messi is in a left midfield position, and he's walking, Andrew, and he sees the guy ahead of him is about to run in and is open and is going to score. And he does something that I do. So I live in Brooklyn, and there's lots of parents with kids on those, you know, those push scooters.
Okay, and, yeah.
But these kids seem too young to be careening down the streets on them. And often these kids are like yards, 100 yards, 50 yards ahead of their parents, right? Heading towards an intersection on the pavement, the crosswalk. And I get so uptight about it. So right as they're heading towards the crosswalk, I look across my shoulder. I just scan to see how far away the parent is, because I'm genuinely scared that they're going to get in and go and get crushed by a bus or something. Jeez. So as they get to the crosswalk, usually these kids are sat, not usually, always they're savvy enough that they stop their scooters. They are in control. But my mind is worst case scenario. So I break into this little trot, and then I realize, it's okay. That's what Messi did. He sees the guy, he sees the danger, he sees the child about to be crushed at the intersection by a bus, and he does this little trot. And then he just says, no, I can't be bothered. And sure enough, Leipzig score.
So thankfully, the results in your situations were not as disastrous as Messi's.
Correct.
Because the equivalent of them scoring would be a child getting well.
Yeah, my point is more that the little trot that Messi did,
the feigning of interest
for like 3 seconds, and he's like, I can't be bothered. And that I do that on the street because I'm afraid of children on scooters. I also I'm afraid at some point in their lives they'll form a scooter gang and just rule the neighborhood with abandon.
That could happen. In addition to Messi in this game, we should mention too, Kylian Mbappe scored a great goal for PSG. I mean, just kind of like a classic Mbappe type of goal.
Read the situation, read the defender's intentions, and totally wrong-footed Galassi in the goal. It was brilliant. It was such a good goal. And that was, you're right, that was vintage him.
Now, however, something happened with him near the end of this game that makes you wonder. So PSG earned a penalty when this was still, it was 3-2 in stoppage time. He had a chance to put it away with a penalty, and he skied it over the bar. Mm. And you just wonder now, okay, this guy, you know, between what happened at the Euros, another missed penalty here in the Champions League.
He had that penalty in the Nations League, that competition they like to sneak in front of us every now and again. And he had a penalty, but it wasn't that convincing. he scored it. If I remember, it wasn't convincing. I might have that wrong. Maybe it was better, but at least he's, yeah, maybe it's becoming a thing for him, a bit of a mental tick.
Yeah, I just wonder. There's a lot of guys there who can do the penalties.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, I understand them wanting him to, you know, either, I don't know if it's boosting his stats, boosting his confidence, just seeing the ball go in the net, but he was playing well. He scored a goal in this game. I don't know that he needed it. But yeah, just something to kind of keep an eye on. Quickly on Leipzig and Jesse Marsch. Tough result for them. They played well against a really difficult opponent on the road. And they are struggling in the Champions League and in the Bundesliga as well, where they only have 3 wins from 8 games. They're 8th right now in the table.
Yeah.
So it has not been a great start.
Defending is a real problem for them. You can't say that they don't have that verve or organization going forward. I mean, look at Angelino's pass for, was it Nkunku's goal? That little cross. The way he hit that ball, by the way, is so unique. Usually you see that whipped. But he floated it right in. It was, but, you know, it didn't have a high trajectory. Yeah, but Jesse Marsch looked pretty crestfallen. We also had another bad night as Tyler Adams made a mistake in the lead up to a goal. By the way.
And then he did the thing. And then he Bruno Fernandes did afterwards and apologized on social media.
Yeah, he did it on an Instagram story, which saved us all having to read everything that Bruno had written. You know, that piece from the Torah length. It was Tyler Adams at least gave us brevity, but I don't think he should have to apologize. There was a lot of things happened before the ball went in the net. It shouldn't be, Tyler Adams gave the ball away in that position. It's definitely a goal. And that kind of speaks to Leipzig's defending problems.
By the way, Tyler Adams also played a role in Leipzig scoring their second goal when he won possession. Now, again, like with the goal, he I guess had a hand in conceding. A lot of things had to happen after Adams won that ball back, but he played a role in Leipzig's second. So, but yeah, he apologized and, you know, he's our guy. And I felt bad that he was feeling bad, but
yeah, he didn't have a bad game, to be honest. You know, he did a lot of good things. It's just, that's the one that always overshadows.
Yeah. A couple others to mention here, JJ, obviously Manchester United. We have to talk about what happened here.
Yeah.
This was just, you know, we've made jokes over the last year about Ole constantly getting to the edge of the cliff. He's about to fall and then some force of nature pushes him back to safety. And this game was sort of like a microcosm of his entire tenure at Manchester United. They're down 2-0. You go on Twitter and just type in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and it's just pure vitriol.
He's booed off at halftime.
And then they score 3 straight and they win in dramatic fashion. And it's, you know, happy days are here again. And everyone, it's all love. And I don't know how sustainable that model is. I would suggest you might already be seeing that it's not sustainable, that Manchester United are underachieving for what we thought they would be. But
funny,
in terms of an individual night, just the singular game, what a thrilling game to have been a part of if you were a Manchester United fan, certainly.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Mark Critchley, our friend, he echoes your thoughts. Is this sustainable? I write for the 1,037th time, which is so true. The winning goal was such. I know it's a great Ronaldo header, but I've come to expect that now from him. It's not even up there with my favorite Ronaldo header, which was the one for Juventus against Sampdoria in 2019. That was. He had like Jordan-esque hang time on that one. But this was a great header too. What was truly great was the delivery from Luke Shaw. It's such a brilliant cross. He's left it right on a plate for him. Now, Atalanta were out on their feet. And Atalanta are they're a team that are just so amazing. They throw so many people going forward that United scoring 3 to come back and win 3-2 is not a crazy, crazy thing to happen against Atalanta. Against Gasperini's teams, this can absolutely happen. But this isn't obviously sustainable. You can't keep playing like this. You can't keep having like Harry Maguire popping up for the second goal, you know, at the back post for the equalizer. Things like that can't continue to happen. It's not sustainable. In lieu of any other plan, you can't have this kind of chaos factor at United. But they did play better than they did at the weekend against Leicester, so I guess that's something.
Well, yeah, a couple of things stand out to me from what we've seen. First of all, I think we have to talk at least briefly about Marcus Rashford. Since he's been reintroduced to the side, he scored against Leicester, scored in this one, both goals were really good goals. And, you know, I think so many moves were made in attack for them. They have so many players there. We were wondering, is there still a spot for him? There is. He's still an excellent player, and he's still so young. His speed, his finishing ability, I think as he works his way back into the side and they figure out how to use him alongside Cristiano and Mason Greenwood and Bruno Fernandes. I mean, there's a lot to work with, and it's going to be a challenge for Solskjaer to figure it out as these guys are trying to figure it out themselves. But I think Rashford, I do think he's got to play if he's healthy.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that's going to happen, Andrew. I agree with you. He's been good since he's been reintroduced into the side, but yeah, I don't know about that.
Here's kind of why I say that, because I do believe, so I saw Jamie Carragher and Gary Neville kind of arguing about Manchester United and what's wrong with them. Carragher seems to think it's a Ronaldo problem, in that the residual effect of playing him means you've got to play Pogba in a position where he's not suited to play. And that's the root of the problems. It begins with Ronaldo. I tend to side more with the Gary Neville side of the argument, which is that Neville was essentially saying that they just need some of these guys to work harder. Like it's not a question of guys that can't do it. Solskjaer has to just get them to do it. And I think Rashford, to me, is somebody who can do that, who is.
So he's going to do the run and Ronaldo won't do then. Is that what you're telling me?
I'm saying, but a lot of teams have players, like, it's not unusual for your number nine to also not get back and defend. Like, I don't think Romelu Lukaku is a player who's asked to get back and defend for Chelsea. So if Solskjaer, he's got to get the other guys. Rashford, to me, is someone who can do that, who can get back and be willing to defend like that.
It's not just about getting back. It's about getting forward too when you don't have the ball. And like, as Michael Cox pointed out, I've already on Monday's pod, we read out what he said about Leicester finding it easy to play through the centre because Ronaldo is essentially a passenger in that phase of the game. Brendan Rodgers said it too. Brendan Rodgers basically said in his post-match comments how it was easy for them to play through the center because they don't have anyone pressing. And who is that person who leads the line and needs to do more in the press? That's Ronaldo. Ronaldo, to his credit, in the last 5 minutes of this game when they were 3-2 up, was back defending and had a clearance in the box. You know, but that, as much as anything, that was about, you know, that's last minute defending. That's work. That's good. And it needs to be done, et cetera, et cetera. But the press, stopping the opposition playing through you and playing through your midfield. And I agree with you, Andrew. That midfield is not, it's not good. And there's other guys in there that need to work as well. But he went back to the Scott McTominay and Fred mm-hmm. formation last night. He left Pogba out and it still didn't work. And you can't, one thing is you can't criticize Fred or Scott McTominay for hard work. You just simply can't. There'll be hard work, but it doesn't work. It's still not working in there. And partly that's because it's too easy to play through Manchester United. Now, what does this mean for the weekend? Well, Paul Scholes thinks that even at full time after the 3-2 win, this is the comment he had to make on BT Sport. He just kind of scornfully shook his head and said, go and do that against Liverpool on Sunday. See what happens. Imagine Jurgen Klopp watching that at home, rubbing his hands together. I was curious what you thought of that, because I don't actually agree with that. I think if you look at Liverpool, tough night on Tuesday against Atleti, and you know, maybe we're seeing little weaknesses, little holes in the armor, and United have come off this 3-2 win, and United are at home. You know, things are okay in the garden again, and they're playing against a team that they know, albeit not the last time Liverpool visited Old Trafford, they battered United, but they're visiting, Liverpool tend not to do great at Old Trafford. You know, it's under Klopp.
I hear all the qualifiers that you're laying down, but I look at that game and think Liverpool are the better team and they're in better form. I would expect Liverpool to win that.
Mm. I'm not so sure. I think that could be a draw, or United could sneak a win. Yeah, I'm not so sure.
I mean, look, anything's possible, but when I sit down to watch that game, my expectation will be that Liverpool should win this.
Well, Liverpool are the kind of team that United should be good against and have to be good against. But in the way Liverpool set up, they're going to have most of the ball. They're going to play a high line, irregardless of the fact that it's at Old Trafford and they're away from home. It won't matter. Liverpool won't change things. and they'll United will sit in, they'll soak up pressure, and if they can do things on the break, Andrew, with the quality they have, I mean, it might be a fun game.
Yeah, I would expect it to be fun, certainly. I just think highly of Liverpool right now, certainly.
I
mean, more
so
than,
do I. I'm just United. Making the case for the opposition.
What are you up to? There's always an ulterior motive. Is this some sort of self-defense mechanism? Is this you placating the United fans that think
really
you're
placating.
Biased?
I mean, how many wins have Liverpool under Klopp at Old Trafford? Add them up. It's not one, I think, in the last how many? So, wins in the league, I mean. So, there we go. That's how I feel.
Let's see. Anything else from these Champions League games? I had a couple quick notes I wanted to mention.
No, you go ahead. Give me your notes.
Chelsea 4-0, but it comes at a cost. Lukaku and Timo Werner both get hurt in this one. Werner,
I thought that was strange, Andrew, because pre-game Tuchel was talking about how he thinks Lukaku has played too many games and is tired. And then he starts him. You know, it's not like they're short of options. And it's Malmo, and right. It's at home. Wasn't that the time to give him a rest, give him a break?
Yeah. It seemed like Tuchel, he kept kind of referring to Lukaku being overused for Belgium.
Okay, well, give him a break. You've got an opportunity. You've got more than enough attacking talent against Malmo.
This is from Sky Sports. They write, with 5 games to come over the next 17 days, Tuchel will be glad the Blues' opponents do not include a side in the top half of the Premier League and in Europe. The only team they will face is a return game against Wednesday's beaten opponents, Malmo, in the Champions League. But I guess their other opponents in the Premier League are bottom half. So if they're without these guys for that entire stretch, they should, like you just said, Chelsea have a lot in the tank. They should still have enough to get results in those games, but that's unfortunate for them, certainly.
Yeah, they got Norwich in the league on Saturday. They've got they've got Southampton in the AFL Cup on the Tuesday, so they're going to rest players there anyway. Then they've got Newcastle away on October 30th, and then Malmo at home, and then Burnley, and they don't play a top half team until they play Leicester on November the 20th.
The team that you are imminently bored with, Bayern Munich, they do win. And I wanted to mention that Robert Lewandowski has now scored 200 goals across all club competitions since the start of the 17-18 season. That's 200 goals in 194 games.
That's a lot.
Ridiculous.
A lot of goals.
Ridiculous. And then finally, JJ, Barcelona finally scored a goal in the Champions League. And it was enough for them to win. And it was from a defender in Gerard Piqué.
Teased them up nicely for the weekend.
Yeah. Barcelona's first goal this Champions League season. That's the longest in terms of match days that the club has taken to score in a single Champions League campaign, as you would expect. I can't envision any scenario where it would have taken them.
And Dest again finds himself in a right wing position, not a full back position. Hello.
And played very well to the point where it caught Danny Alves's attention. And I saw Danny Alves talking about how bright he thinks Sergiño Dest's future is at Barcelona. So that's a nice endorsement to get.
It is indeed a nice endorsement to get. And it's, I wonder if Greg is at home. Triple G is at home with a glass of wine, stroking his chinny chin chin, thinking about maybe Dest on the right. Dest as a winger. We've had this conversation off air.
We had it off air.
You made the same noise.
Because it's interesting. And I think it is something he's got to think about. I mean, we talked on the podcast after the US's win where Dest scored the goal, but was kind of culpable in the one they conceded, that he's there because of what he brings in attack, not defense. And it happens to be a moment in time where the US has options at that right back position. Now it comes down to whether or not you think, okay, is Reggie Cannon ready to step in immediately in World Cup qualifying and beyond and be the right back?
Yedlin.
Right. Is it still Yedlin who can hold that position down? At some point, we think Brian Reynolds will come into the fold, although we're certainly not at that point yet. But we are in a moment of time where if they want to move Dest further up, they can try it. I wouldn't necessarily be against it. But then you're also now talking about either kind of reshaping your formation or who are you going to take off? I mean, is Yunus Musa come off? Does Gio Reyna come off? You know, you're going to have to sacrifice somebody who's already in a more forward attacking role. So, but I wouldn't be against seeing it. I would not be against seeing it. I guess that leads into a nice little segue, JJ, for this weekend. El Clasico, Barcelona, Real Madrid. This is a big one early on in the season. As right now, you look at the table, Real Madrid are second behind Real Sociedad, 3 points back, but they do have a game at hand. Barcelona sits seventh, also only 8 games played. A lot of the teams around them are up at nine, but only 5 points back of Sociedad and only 2 points back of Real Madrid. So, you know, you hear that Barcelona are seventh, you think, oh, what's up with that? But they're actually, they're right there and could be ahead of them, depending on how things go this weekend. And JJ, you know, we keep talking about Barcelona and like the dire financial situation they're in. The performances are down. Do they not like this manager? Is Joan Laporta trying to get rid of this guy? Well, I'll say this about Barcelona. Like I've continued to say, there are still great players there, yada, yada. People are probably sick of hearing me say that. The one thing I will say, how terrible and dire can your situation truly be when you have not one, but two players with billion-dollar, billion-euro release clauses on your team? That's not a bad starting point.
No. No, it's not.
That tells you really young players, extraordinary talent. So, like, okay, they're in a transition phase right now. But I don't know. I wonder a little bit about the notion that we've talked about that Barcelona are heading into some vortex where they're going to qualify for Champions League some years. They're not in others, and that's going to be how it is for the next, you know, for this generation. Maybe I'm not there yet. I still, you know, I they don't have to win La Liga every year, but I'm not ready to say that. I don't think the expectation should be lowered that much for them.
Yeah. What I'm wondering about is not so much them, but their opposition and Karim Benzema. That is a very, very interesting one for me. So he's coming into this game in La Liga with 9 goals and 7 assists, red hot form, kind of become the main man. Well, not kind of, is the main man at Real Madrid now. He is out of all the various shadows that once surrounded him. He is the head honcho at Real Madrid. And I'm wondering if he can make this Clásico his own. Not to mention that the trial in France involving Mathieu Valbuena, and Karim Benzema, who obviously isn't going to be present in court, that began this week. So that's another interesting little subtext for Karim Benzema ahead of this El Clasico.
Yes, I would say so. That's off the field. But you are right. In terms of on the field, he has taken the reins. Like, he has taken the responsibility of being the next great Real Madrid player, and he's run with it. In all competitions this season, that's 16 games so far, 13 goals, 9 assists. Spectacular. Really spectacular thus far from him. Should be a fun one this weekend. Last note on Ansu Fati, who got, I don't even know if I said his name. He's the guy I was referring to as being one of the two Barcelona players with a billion euro release clause. 15 goals for Barcelona, 3 assists in 48 games since his senior debut. He's still just unbelievably young. It should be fun. This is for Barcelona, I think, much more so than Real Madrid. It's a measuring stick game, and I'm really curious how this one will play out for them. Should be interesting, no question about it. All right, I'll tell you what. Let's take a quick break. When we come back on the other side, there's a lot to get to. We talked about some of the news and notes happening around the world of football, the biennial World Cup, the Newcastle takeover. There's a lot to discuss, and Tarek Panja of the New York Times is kind enough to do that with us next. You won't want to miss that conversation. More Caught Offside still to come. Oh, back now on Caught Offside. JJ, we mentioned this at the top of the show, how back during the Super League and all of the chaos that took place within, in the end, what was it, like a 72-hour period of chaos. But amongst that chaos, we did multiple shows in that window, and one of them featured Tarek Panja of the New York Times, and the response that we got to that interview was so overwhelmingly positive during what was kind of a dark time for the sport. And so now whenever, you know, news and notes and things like that are happening around the world of soccer, he is, of course, one of the people that we love to speak with most. And he's with us once again to talk about a few different issues happening right now in soccer. Tarek Panja from the New York Times. What's up, man? How are you?
Yeah, not bad. Good to be with you guys.
Yeah, we appreciate you making some time. We had initially, when we reached out to you, we kind of want to talk about the Newcastle situation, and we will certainly do that. But within the last couple of days or so, this biennial World Cup, this every 2 year World Cup idea seemed like it was gaining steam. It seemed like FIFA were going to push this through come hell or high water. And I know there's a lot of fans out there that are really concerned about this. I don't get the sense from at least the people we interact with on this show. I don't get the sense that a lot of the fans want this. And I'm kind of wondering, what is the state of the biennial World Cup right now?
It is. That's a very good question. I suppose it is, again, in this discussion stage, but it's not really a discussion. In some parts, I describe it as maybe a shouting stage. FIFA initially were talking or preaching to the converted. They were talking to, you know, Africa, for example, first. And when you talk about confederation like that, in a sense, that is almost a subsidiary of FIFA. FIFA essentially took over the African Football Confederation about a year ago because of internal issues there. And the leadership of national FAs on that continent have pretty much been doing FIFA's bidding and have been sort of nodding in agreement for political reasons as much as sporting reasons. And that was always going to be the case with this. Where it was always going to be tricky was with Europe. Both UEFA, the European Confederation, the clubs, you know, it's without doubt, no disrespect to any other part of the world, the global club game is centered in Europe, and that's the power base of that. And the leagues, by the same token, are extremely powerful. And they've been wholly opposed to that, uniformly, be it the UEFA, be it the leagues, be it the clubs, and even the often current players and coaches who are still active in the game at the moment. FIFA has enlisted a group of former players, very famous people, but they don't play the game anymore, and they are wearing FIFA T-shirts when they're talking on behalf of FIFA. So, you know, unsurprisingly, that they've been quite positive, and some of the people who haven't been quite so positive haven't been given the airtime by FIFA to talk about this. This week has been particularly interesting. There was a FIFA council meeting on Wednesday. But before that, on Tuesday, Gianni Infantino, the FIFA president, entered, you know, I suppose the lion's den over Zoom, sort of discussed the plans for the reform of the calendar led by the biennial World Cup with the 55 national association heads, and he was given a torrid time. One after another, they rebuked him personally, some of them, and rebuked the plan. And in many instances, it was like, you know, why are you taking away from us in order to do this? Where's all the rationale? There's Gianni says, yeah, we're doing the sporting side now, the how it would look and how it worked, and then we're going to discuss the finances. We're still figuring it out what the financial impact will be, both on the tournament and on the rest of the game. But he was also pushing for a vote on December the 20th. They were like, hang on a minute. If none of this has been worked out, why are we having a vote on December the 20th? Mm-hmm. And then he was given pretty much a stark warning, not in so many words, not so explicitly, but reading between the lines. Both from the Nordic associations and also, I believe, from the UEFA president, Alexander Seferin, who described if this went to a vote, there could be severe consequences. And the Nordic federation said, we will have to figure out where we sit in the football landscape. All this, to me, is mood music to you push us so far, we will leave FIFA.
Yeah.
And that's where we are. And I think that focused the minds ahead of this FIFA council meeting that took place on Wednesday, where Gianni Infantino had been expected to get an agreement to take this reform package over a biennial World Cup for men and women and a change of the calendar, like two blocks of national team football, etc. All of this is small beer compared, let's be honest, to the Men's World Cup, given that it's 93% of FIFA's income every 2 years. To take it to this vote on December the 20th, and he pulled back from the brink.
I was reading your tweets, and Infantino made an appeal for the children. This is for the children that we're doing it.
I was touched. But really, what is the driving force behind this? Just to have World Cup revenues every 2 years? Is it really just that simple?
It's very hard to kind of look beyond this. There is that. And then there's also, look, he for me, you have to look at the psychology of the man as well, I think, in a way. He appeared from relatively nowhere. I mean, he had a senior role in European football, but he was never discussed at that time as the next or as a future FIFA president. Mm-hmm. He was in UEFA, secretary general, good job, but not the leader of world football. May 2015 happens, a bunch of people get arrested, FIFA nearly closes down, and that pretty much shakes the sort of kaleidoscope, and this man emerges as the FIFA president. You know, he then is there in this really powerful position, and he's kind of really enjoyed the power, it seems like. He loves being photographed with presidents. I mean, real presidents, not presidents of sports organizations. You know, be it several visits with Donald Trump or Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Paul Kagame in Rwanda, you know, there is this sense of, you know, I'm a man of substance and I want to be shoulder to shoulder with these people. And I think with that comes a degree of legacy.
Right.
I want to do something. Because if you think about it, it must be quite boring being the FIFA president compared to, say, what he was doing at UEFA. UEFA have the Champions League, club competitions, Europa League, and then this great Euro. So there's always something to do. The FIFA president has this enormous tournament, but it's the biggest, most popular sports event in the world, including the Olympics, I'd say. But it's every 4 years, and he's young. You know, he needs something to do. So we've seen a lot of kind of missteps about, first it was going to be this Club World Cup, you know, and I remember being in Colombia in Bogota in 2018 in March, where he said to the council, guys, you got to sign this paper. I'm not going to tell you who it's with, but I've been promised $25 billion. I've got it, and the deal has to be done in 60 days. I've signed an NDA. I can't tell you who it's with, but it's for these Club World Cups, but let me do it. And he had his pants pulled down. You know, they said absolutely no chance. Certainly Europeans were saying, what Club World Cup? $25 billion with who? What about, you know, champion? You know, so that happened. And there's been other kind of promises and ideas. Right. And now we've lighted on this biennial World Cup, you know, suddenly appeared in May of this year by the Saudi FA, you know, fig leaf for FIFA perhaps. And again, it's being rushed through, like, we need to do it, we need to do it, we need to do it. December 20th, we have to have a vote. And it feels like another idea, and again, headlong rush straight into a concrete wall. So there is the psychology a little bit of the man. And then in terms of what there is, yes, again, he hasn't shown us the finances. People I've spoken to, there is no way that it will be double. You have it twice, so it will double. It doesn't work like that. There is finite commercial money, there's finite TV money, and then the appeal of something that is not as rare as it once was is an important factor here. But it would be more if you add, I don't know, say it's worth $6 billion now, add another $3 billion, say, add the, you know, 3.5, maybe you get to $8 billion for two rather than six right. for one. You know, my maths aren't great. You know what I mean.
I know.
It would be a bit more, but it wouldn't be double. So there's that stuff, and then there is the kind of politics of football. How do you become FIFA president? You become the FIFA president by promising 211 national associations something, and most of them are small. But all of them have the same voting rights. So Guam, you know, an island nation of God knows, you know, thousands of people, will have the same voting rights as Brazil, 200 million, same as USA, Germany. So these are all sops. This is all electioneering often as well. This is the structure of football. And again, for me, it speaks to something that really needs to be looked at again, torn down and started from scratch. Because to me, it seems outrageous in a way that clubs who employ all these players, whether they're in Europe or Brazil or Asia or wherever, have no say over what happens. The leagues have no say. Players' unions have no say. And then suddenly, you know, Bangladesh decides what's going to happen. And no offense to Bangladesh, it should have a say. But you know, Barcelona doesn't have a say. To me, that we might need to relook at how decision-making works in football. And this is a structural problem, not just at FIFA, but at regional level, at the confederations too. So it's a long way of saying, money's a very important, probably the most important part of this. But again, one of, you know, perhaps ego over control, rivalry, and football politics.
Tarek, something I'm wondering about with this, you know, so thinking about it a little bit in terms of what happened with the Super League. So you have this outrageous idea, it explodes in a ball of fire, it doesn't come to fruition, but in the end, certain changes are made that do placate some of these clubs. Champions League is altered in some way. Is there an equivalent to this? We've got this outrageous idea, biennial World Cup. Right now, UEFA is putting up resistance, CONMEBOL as well. Probably, I would say at this moment, doesn't look like it's going to happen. What comes out of this in the end? Is there some sort of compromise that we should be looking forward to?
Yeah, often there has to be something, I guess. I agree the calendar needs to change. I'm not a big fan of the current calendar. You know, for example, you had a situation here where the European season started in late August, early September, and within 2 weeks it was stopped for 10 days for national team football. Mm-hmm. After the pandemic, fans have not been in the stadiums, and then suddenly they're in, and then it's frozen again for these qualifiers. Some of them aren't particularly appealing. And then we're going to have these blocks. I agree with Wenger on this. There's way too many blocks of national team football that are interspersed into the league season. So something needs to give. I don't know what the answer is, because apparently broadcasters do not like the idea of one single block. They think the eyeballs will go. If you ask me, I actually like it. Anything that is linear and you can build a story as a journalist, I think is great. I'm looking at it from a very selfish point of my point of view, is that you can follow the storyline and then they have a climax, etc.
TV probably likes that too.
Sorry?
TV probably likes that concept too.
Yeah, the problem apparently is if the rarity of the national team games for those broadcasters is that there's only two and then you have to wait or something. Again, it's not good from a storytelling point of view, but apparently it doesn't work. I don't know. I don't know. I'm with you. I thought they'd love it, but apparently maybe not. But we'll see. So something needs to be done there. And then there is no harm in having some type of new tournament or event or whatever, you know, because, well, if it works for everyone and it improves opportunities and it speaks to some of the problems for that Gianni, I think perhaps rightly, is trying to fix. Maybe some of the lesser teams don't get enough opportunity to play in competitions. Maybe they will have a chance. So one thing that is being mooted, and you have to go back to say 2017 when this idea first came appeared, is a global Nations League type of concept. And with the Nations League, we have one in Europe and we have one in the CONCACAF region in North America, which is not the Gold Cup or the Euro. It isn't a friendly. It is a seeded league, as it were, based on quality. So divisions 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. And they culminating in a semi-finals for each band. So even the teams in the poorest level will have a final or a trophy to win or something like that. On a global level, some people are saying, well, these things could feed into these mini global tournaments, potentially. An idea. I don't know how appealing that will be to viewers or to broadcasters or sponsors, but it might speak to some of the issues that Gianni and co are trying to fix in terms of creating more competitive games for teams and get rid of friendlies. So that's one. Another idea along the same lines as maybe these Nations Leagues will feed into a one and done type of a March Madness type of competition. And you'll have something. So not as onerous as a World Cup, but something. Right. So and then also Gianni Infantino, after the FIFA Council meeting this week, he did a press conference. It just shows how kind of loose this all is, and I don't understand why the rush for a vote. He said, "Well, look, we send us your ideas if you have any." So, guys, send him your ideas. You know, if a man is asking for ideas, I don't know what he wanted to vote on in like 2 months' time.
Yeah, that's very true. Speaking of votes, Tariq, let's move it on to Newcastle. So Saudi Arabia are now firmly ensconced in the Premier League. This has happened, and immediately it seems as if the other Premier League clubs have moved to clip their wings somewhat. Can you tell us what happened this week?
Yeah, so the Saudi takeover finally happened. We have the Public Investment Fund, sovereign wealth fund of the Saudi Arabia, buying 80% of Newcastle. Premier League somehow are still insisting that they've got legally binding assurances that this public investment fund and the owners of Saudi Arabia are separate from the Saudi state, even though the de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, is chairman of the public investment fund, even though Yasser Al-Rumayyan, the governor of PIF, is also the chairman of Aramco, the state oil company of Saudi Arabia, even though the PIF is the vehicle of choice for the Saudi state's Vision 2030 plan to revolutionize the countries all outside Premier League. So the deal goes through. Premier League clubs are up in arms. And again, this is out of self-interest. No one be in any doubt. This isn't about human rights or anything like that as far as these clubs are concerned. This is the venality of modern football in a way. So there is a new competitor in town, a new potential risk to the table, the top six Champions League places, or even every place is worth a few million. So they said, a group of the teams, 18 of them this week, voted out of the 20 to tell the Premier League we need a moratorium on so-called related party transactions. And that means no sponsorships from any organization or brand or company connected to the ownership of the teams. They didn't specifically say Newcastle, but this is completely with Newcastle in mind, because everybody knows and remembers what happened with Manchester City. 2008, a different vehicle was created, fronted by the brother of the ruler of Abu Dhabi, Sheikh Mansour bin Zayed Al Nahyan. And suddenly a slew of Abu Dhabi UAE companies led by Etihad, the airlines, is now sponsoring Manchester City for huge amounts of money. That cash enabled City to start the journey that has seen it reach where it is today, perennial Premier League champions, aspirant Champions League winner, one of the most powerful football teams in the world. Eventually, the idea is you throw enough money at a project, you'll probably be successful. So for now, they've put this moratorium on. Funny enough, Manchester City was the only other team not supporting this temporary ban.
They abstained, didn't they? They abstained.
They abstained, apparently, on legal advice related to this being illegal and a cartel-like behavior, but whatever. There's 3 weeks until the next Premier League shareholders meeting where this ban will be in place, where they're asking for something perhaps more concrete to come into force. I personally can't see how it can be policed, to be honest with you. Well, especially once the Premier League has decided the PIF is not part of Saudi Arabia. So then how are you going to do the related party transactions? I think that it's a misnomer. I think maybe, and correctly, they may come up with a rule that says every sponsorship must be analysed for fair value. And then take it from there. But the horse, I think the horse has bolted a long time ago. I don't think the Premier League is particularly effective at governing its own rules. There is a case involving Manchester City related to alleged financial fair play abuses linked to the leaks in those football league documents that is now dragged on for 3 years without an outcome. In that time, Manchester City has won at least 2 league titles. So, you know, it's a mess. It's a mess. And this shows it up, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Last one for me on this, Tarek. I mean, JJ and I have talked at length over the last week and a half or so about this subject, and there's any number of reasons to be concerned with it. Kind of an open-ended one for you, but what is chiefly among your concerns here with what we're seeing?
It could be any state, but a state owning a football club in England, to me, seems off. You've got to remember where these are obviously global satellites and networks, etc., have made the Premier League a lot bigger than it was, or English football. These matches have beamed all around the world. But these clubs are community institutions, really. They're wedded into where they're from. There's 100 year plus of history here. It means something to the community. It's just being sold off like, you know, a piece of fish to whoever, you know, who wants to buy it. That doesn't sit right with a lot of people. And with this particular regime, you know.
However, I hate to interrupt you, but the people who you're talking about, the community of Newcastle, it seems to sit very well with them. They seem to have fallen in line immediately.
Which gets to the heart of, I guess, modern football in a way. I think anything could be excused. Now, I'd like to ask those people who are wearing those Saudi Arabian or Arabic garments and waving Saudi flags in Newcastle ahead of that first game against Tottenham, what would it take? Is there anything beyond the pale? Or if someone promises you they can buy you the best players in the world, you are willing to overlook anything? Yeah. You know, obviously they've been able to overlook the murder of our colleague, another journalist,
yes,
killed in the most gruesome way. His family saw probably will never have the body back. That's not enough. Is it a numbers game? How many of these people need to be killed? Is that something? What if it's someone closer to your family? Women's rights, does it matter? I mean, the thing I found particularly most shocking in all of this was the statement by, I think this organization called Newcastle Pride or something, the LGBTQ supporter group, essentially waving this stuff through with the most mealy-mouthed comments linked to, oh, you know, maybe they'll see how we behave. You're not going to change Saudi Arabian behavior, guys. It just, to me, it seems success on the football field trumps everything. And that's maybe where society has got to today. And it's bigger than a conversation about Newcastle and Premier League football for another day. But again, for me, this doesn't sit well. The other point is there's been people who've said, oh, well, you didn't complain when they own Uber and Twitter and investments. And it's complete non sequitur as far as I'm concerned, right? Because this is so different. These are companies. They have no kind of fan base, not millions, hundreds of thousands of Twitter fans, Uber fans in the street who would now be trumpeting or parroting the Saudi line on human rights or on diplomacy or other policy, which is exactly what we've seen with Newcastle, not just now, for a year since the deal. This is completely different. They have now somehow, they say Saudi Arabia has now managed to get, I guess, a bunch of surrogates for their worldview or the worldview of this current government. That doesn't happen in any other sphere of life.
I was particularly shocked because it's only 8 years ago since Sunderland and the miners' unions in Durham stood out and protested the appointment, not of a new owner, but of a new manager who had
links to far right political views in Italy. I actually thought there would be a little bit of pushback considering the working class and unionized nature of that area.
Yeah, it's interesting you make that point. They were also complaining about, funny enough, Mike Ashley's work practices, the sports director and the previous owner. Now, if you look at the kafala system that is in place in Saudi Arabia for foreign laborers, for the people that essentially keep that country running, I would argue it is as worse, if not a lot worse, than what Mike Ashley has going one of his Sports Direct factories. But again, I just think people have been seduced by this this idea that they've been delivered from the tyrant that is this sports cheap sportswear manufacturer, and replaced by someone who's going to bring the good times. And you have to have a degree of cognitive dissonance, right? You've got to forget all this bad stuff and just concentrate on the football. I don't know. I think maybe when some of the people go home, and they know. Also, the victories are going to be a little bit tainted.
Oh, 100. Sense. Even there's more.
There's this stuff, but there's also, well, so what? You just bought everything. There isn't any plan.
I think it's going to be even more than what Manchester City fans have got for the last decade, because I think it's more out front and center what this is, who they are. And I think everything that it will never be the same for Newcastle fans again. I think they think they got their club back, but I think their club has never been further away from them.
I think that, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, if getting your club back means handing it over to you know, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, you know, maybe my English isn't as good as what it ought to be, because it doesn't mean that to me. Getting something back, sending it thousands of miles away into the hands of a, you know, absolute monarch, it seems very odd.
Yeah, certainly does. Fascinating stuff. Tarek, we always appreciate your time and talking through some of these bigger issues affecting the sport. Thanks so much, man.
Thanks, guys. Nice to be with you again.
Tarek Panja, love speaking with him. Fascinating. Yeah, both times we've gotten a chance to talk to him.
If I could put together a short list of people I'd love to have a pint with and just talk about all these issues through, he's absolutely that. I hope people enjoyed that.
Yeah, we do have to get out, but a couple of the things that he said did resonate with me specifically. I mean, we can talk about the biennial World Cup thing on another day,
yeah,
and a change to the calendar. Maybe we'll throw that idea out there to all of our listeners. I would love the Reddit page to begin submitting their ideas to Infantino for what changes need to be made to the FIFA calendar.
The animals will do
what
that.
Tournaments you want to see, whatever. Like,
the animals have no. They've spent enough time talking about how much I like WAP. Wet ass pitches, so they'll have plenty of time to talk about this.
But last bit before we close out on the Newcastle thing, a couple things Tarek said are interesting to me. First of which, the kind of subtle dig that he threw out there of they know, but we talked about they just want to win, and right now that's the
I
thing.
Know, but
is,
that's not. It's just not a moral. You know, it's not.
You're right.
You can't square that circle, you know?
I agree with you. But I think that, you know, the thing I wonder about is if you're a club like Newcastle who's contending with relegation, like, is the cat so out of the bag that this is your only avenue into glory? Is there any other way other than being bought by, I mean, I don't think it should have to be a nation, but some kind of multi-billionaire, like the New York Mets here in baseball getting bought by Steve Cohen. Like, is this Newcastle or Burnley or whoever, is it their only avenue into greater success?
That is the problem of the unfair and unequal distribution of wealth down the divisions. I'm not just talking down the Premier League, down the divisions, that has created this, Andrew. Like, Liverpool, Manchester United, because of their success over the decades, have been insulated, and their commercial revenues, even before TV revenues, insulated them from all these things,
right?
And they've been allowed to continue doing that. I always go back, it's only 5 years ago they negotiated to get the top six to get the largest sum of the TV money. You know, that is a definite problem. But, you know, there has to be you know, the point about community-based clubs. Like, the whole point of going to see Liverpool is that you're going to be on Anfield Road. You're going to be drinking in the Arkles. You're going to be going to the game. You're going to meet Scousers. It's a community-based thing. People have been going there for years. And that's what we football, we as football fans always say, that's what makes our game different. It's community-based. You know, I've been taking my boy there for 40 years to Newcastle, to St. James's Park. Then it does matter who you sell these clubs to. And it's a shame that we've set up a economic ecosphere where the only way to get ahead is to take these huge amounts of money from dubious actors. That is a problem. No, 100%. And it's beyond Newcastle United.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, fascinating stuff. I enjoyed this podcast greatly. The Champions League stuff, it was another great Champions League week. Fascinating games coming up this weekend. Like you mentioned, of course, we've got Liverpool and Manchester United.
I'm on tape delay for United and Liverpool.
Oh my. Good luck.
No, it'll be fine as long as you don't try to you'll hire a plane.
Where will you be exactly?
I'm not telling you that. I'll be on Randall's Island for a soccer game.
Okay. Yeah, disconnect. You got to disconnect. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Like you're not even there, a ghost even.
That's the truth.
Yeah, so you got that, El Clasico. This is a great, great weekend of soccer coming up. Our thanks to Tarek Panja for talking through some of this stuff with us. Fascinating conversation. And we will be back, of course, next week with a look at the soccer weekend still to come. Hey, good stuff, man. To you, I say...
Check you later, fun boy.
I'll see you.
Take care, my man.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.
Seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Your relationships, your skills, your customer base. How about businesses on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/network, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/network now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/network.